Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your solo host today, Monica Hadley. Our guest on Writer's Voices today is, this is really a book that just fits right into the show, I gotta say. Michael Castleman grew up in Malvern, New York, a Long Island suburb of New York City. He's a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Michigan, earned an MA in journalism from the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and has lived in San Francisco since 1975. And the book that we're talking about today is The Untold Story of Books, A Writer's History of Book Publishing. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Michael.
Monica, thank you so much for having me on.
Now, I understand you've been working on this book for a while.
I researched this book for 44 years. That is no joke. 44 years. I signed my first book contract in 1979. And when I did that, I thought, whoa, if I'm going to be involved in this crazy book publishing industry, maybe I should study it and learn about it. Because familiarity with the business side might, you know, give me a leg up in my career. And so I, and that turned out, I don't know if that's really true, but I started researching the book publishing industry daily through anything I could find, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Publishers Weekly, and the memoirs of famous publishers and writers, and just anything I could find about the publishing industry. And I did that for 44 years, and I still do it today. And I don't claim to know everything about publishing, but it was a fascinating research exercise, and eventually it led to The Untold Story of Books.
When did you actually decide there's a book in this?
Well, I decided that in the early 2000s, around 2005, is when I started writing this thing. I didn't suddenly have an epiphany, oh, I'm going to write a book. But eventually, as the research continued and I was writing my other stuff, I've written 19 books. This is my 19th book. I just thought, you know, this is a great story, and it hasn't been told, and let's tell it.
Wow.
But the problem was in 2005, when I started writing the first draft of this book, I was just a little bit angry at publishers for how they had treated me and other authors for so long. You know, in this business, if you're not a best-selling author, you just don't get treated very well. There was a lot of anger in the first draft of this book, and so no publisher wanted it.
I wonder why.
Right. I had friends read the manuscript, and one friend said to me, you know, Mike, there's fantastic stuff in here, but have you ever considered anger management? So then I wrote a second draft that was a lot less angry, but it was still too angry for publishers. And then around, 2015, 16, I wrote a third draft, and I tried to wring out all the anger, and it was still too much for publishers. And I just didn't know what to do. And then what happened was, just by chance, I happened to rehear a song by Elvis Costello. Elvis Costello has a song called Red Shoes. And it opens up with the line, I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused. And I thought, hey, that's interesting. Maybe if I play the story of publishing for its sardonic humor, I can get this thing published. And lo and behold, that's what happened. I rewrote the book. I wrote a fourth draft 2 or 3 years ago. And I tried to play it for humor as opposed to anger. And Unnamed Press of Los Angeles loved it and took it.
Well, the humor definitely comes through, and it's an entertaining read. Which,
thank you.
You know, you might think, okay, that's the history of book publishing. How dry can you get? But it's actually very intriguing, very interesting. Of course, I'm a numbers person, so I like the numbers, and which you have a lot of too in the book. A lot of statistics, dollars, you know, what things cost at different points in time. How did you actually learn some of that? Like some of the really, like that a book costs $600, the equivalent of $600 in colonial times.
Well, there is a four-volume work called The History of Book Publishing in the United States by a guy named John Tabell that was published in 1972. This is a four-volume, 3,000-page, unbelievable tome that has incredible data and facts and numbers like what you just cited in it, but is virtually unreadable. This is an incredible book. It's like everything in the kitchen sink. And so it was, like I said, it was published in 1972 and immediately disappeared. And I found a copy of volume one in the San Francisco Public Library. And I tried to buy the other copies, and it was going to cost like $3,000 to buy this book, and I just couldn't afford it. But then in the early 2000s, a small press on Cape Cod reprinted the thing, and I bought the whole set for, I think, like $300. And it took me 4 years to read the four volumes and take notes on them. But much of the historical information in The Untold Story of Books comes from that work, which is, like I said, it's virtually unreadable. It's incredibly, I mean, the guy who wrote it, Tabell, was an editor at Dutton, I think. And it's just shocking how poorly written and edited this thing is. But, you know, when you're mining for gold, you have to move a lot of rock to find a few nuggets. And I very slowly, painstakingly worked my way through this incredible tome and came up with a lot of the information. And then the rest of the information came from everywhere else. I mean, there's a fair amount published about publishing, but it's just not particularly systematic. And so I just kept being the researcher, taking notes, and tried to write an entertaining, breezy, fast-paced book.
And I think you definitely succeeded. Now, the books that you had, you said this is the 19th book that you've published, and most of the rest are quite different from this.
There's... Oh, yes. The Untold Story of Books is a major departure for me. I've made my career writing about health and sexuality. And most of my books are either health books or sexuality guides. I also had a four-book mystery series about 15, 20 years ago. But I've always been fascinated by history. You know, a lot of people don't like history because it's dull and boring. But if history is told well, it becomes a wonderful story. And I'm a storyteller, and I like to tell stories. And so The Untold Story of Books is that story. And the fact that it's a departure for me was actually kind of refreshing. It was fun to write something a little different. And I had, like I said, I'd written all these other books, and I just wanted to, you know, in later life, I just wanted to try something a little different.
Wow. Well, you definitely succeeded with this. In The Untold Story of Books, you split the history of publishing into what you call three separate kind of businesses of books.
Correct.
Was this your original concept, and how did you decide where the splits actually occurred?
Yes, the history of book publishing is divided into three epochs, and yes, it is my construct. No one else is formulated things this way. But when you look at the economics of book publishing, it becomes very obvious that this is the case. And it has to do with the technology of printing. As printing evolved, changes in authors' relationships to printers and later publishers basically defined the business. And the three epochs are from Gutenberg to the end of the 19th century was the first book business. And in the first book business, there were no publishers as we know them today. Writers, authors, paid printers to print their books. And so people went to Benjamin Franklin and said, hey, I've got this book. Would you print it? And Ben Franklin said, sure, if you pay me. And so early American authors paid to publish. In current parlance, they self-published. And every famous author you ever heard of in American history did this. I mean, James Fenimore Cooper, Herman Melville, Henry David Thoreau, Louisa May Alcott. They all paid to publish their books. They all paid the printer. But what happened over this period from 1450 to the end of the 1800s was that printing itself evolved and changed and got a lot faster. And by the end of the 19th century, high-speed industrial presses could turn out so many books so quickly that the model flipped. And all of a sudden, publishers began paying authors for manuscripts and then turning around and hiring printers to print them. And so the occupation of publisher that we know today dates from around World War I, and all the famous houses like Random House was founded in 1925 and Simon & Schuster was founded in 1924. It's no coincidence that a lot of the big five publishers were founded around the end of World War I, because that's when the model flipped, when all of a sudden publishers started paying authors for manuscripts. And that lasted 80 years, from 1920 to around 2000. That 80-year period is now called traditional publishing, although it's not traditional at all. It was only the reigning model for 80 of publishing almost 600 years. But in our lifetimes, because it's a century old, it began around 1920, we think that that's the way publishing always was. No. Publishers paying authors for manuscripts was an aberration, a detour. And after 2000, with digital publishing, when digital publishing happened, then you could print so many books so quickly. I mean, right now, one lone self-publisher can release an infinite number of ebooks for $100 and distribute them worldwide for next to nothing. So again, the model has flipped. And instead, the big five still do pay the favored few for manuscripts, but 99% of authors have returned to paying to publish. Everyone who self-publishes through Kindle or other self-publishing platforms, they're paying to publish. And in print, a lot of most writers also now pay to publish or get, advances have shrunk down to almost nothing for most people. And so we are now in the third book business, which is a high-tech return to the first book business, where the vast majority of people pay to publish.
But it's very hard for both the writers of the world and even the readers to flip our mindsets to think that it shouldn't be the way it was during the 20th century. You know, we think that's the way it should be and that there's something wrong with the way it is now.
Yes, I have had those thoughts myself. You know, I published a dozen books in the 20th century. And I got advances for all of them. And my advances averaged about $25,000. And that wasn't enough to make me a living. I made my living as a magazine writer. But it certainly was a little extra bonus benefit that, you know, helped my family finances. And when digital publishing first came in, it was hailed as this wonderful thing for writers. No more gatekeepers, no more agents saying no, no more publishers saying no. If you have something to publish, you can publish it. And so it was this sort of blue sky, writer's triumph kind of idea that the pundits were embracing and putting forth. But when you looked at it, so many books became published that they all disappeared. I mean, when I published my first book in 1980, American publishers released 45,000 titles. Today, publishers and self-publishers release 2 million new titles every year. 2 million.
And how do you get attention to your book in that environment?
Right. During the entire 20th century, American publishers released about 2.5 million books. Now that number gets released every year or two. And as you say, it's impossible to get attention. It turns every book into a snowflake in Antarctica, a blade of grass on a golf course. I mean, they're there, but they're just overwhelmed by everybody else. And so it's very hard to get attention. In fact, today it's easier than ever to publish books, but harder than ever to promote and sell them. And sales per title have plummeted, which has really threatened publishers, and it's killed authors' incomes. You know, authors' incomes have plummeted, have fallen by more than half in the last 15 years.
Wow. That's unfortunate. But I guess, I mean, the amount of money being spent on books is probably growing, but it's being spread out among so many more people.
Right. Americans buy about between 800 and 900 million books a year. And they've been doing that for it's fairly steady. The book business, people worry that, you know, the book business is withering. It's not withering. There are ups and downs here and there. I mean, during COVID, book sales went way up. Now they're down a little bit. But Americans buy about 800 million books a year. So the book business is healthy, but on a per title basis, the average book, 4 out of 5 books that are released today sell fewer than 100 copies. That's 80% of books sell fewer than 100 copies. And that's the bad news. Of course, the good news is that if you publish a book and you sell 100 copies, you're in the top 20%.
Well, you're a bestseller.
Well, not exactly, people have to reconfigure their expectations.
Yeah.
And people say to me when I tout these numbers that 80% of books sell fewer than 100 copies, people say, oh, that's so depressing. Well, yeah, on the one hand it is, but on the other hand, if you're going to be a writer, you really have to know the world in which you're living. If you don't understand that world, then all you can do is become disappointed and bitter. If you understand the world you're living in, then you see the challenges clearly and you do what you can to meet them. And so I feel like in the untold story of books, one of the reasons I wrote it was to empower authors to understand the world they actually live in, so that they can keep writing and not get depressed when they only sell, if their book only sells 500, well, 500 is actually pretty good for 2024.
Wow. You know, one of the things about the gatekeepers and how hard it was to get published during the second book business compared to now, I will say as a doing the show, which I've been doing since 2006, if I have a book that's pitched to me from a major publisher, I kind of know that the quality is okay. It may or may not be a book that I'll like, but I'll know that the quality of the writing is decent. Whereas
right.
When I get pitched by a self-published book, I actually have to look at the book before I can decide whether I want to take to do it or not, because it could be horrible.
Right.
Yeah. So
the problem,
having those gatekeepers saved me time.
Well, the problem that you've pointed out is absolutely true. And the issue is editing. A lot of self-published books are either not edited at all or very poorly edited. A lot of people don't understand that the term writing, is a misnomer. What we actually do, we don't write, we rewrite. And smart authors get their work edited extensively. I mean, Untold Story of Books, I paid 3 professional editors $2,500 each to edit this book. So that means, and then I had another 50 friends and other writers I know just read it and give me feedback. The great downfall of self-publishing is that the books are not edited. A lot of self-published books read like they were tossed off in a weekend by an author who never cracked a thesaurus. So in the Untold Story of Books, I exhort writers to have their work edited extensively. I mean, you want to put your best foot forward. You want to have the best read you can have. And that means a lot of editing, a lot of going over and over and over. And yes, it's tedious, but you know what? A much better book is the result.
Of course, the problem is, if you're spending $2,500 to have your book edited and you're selling 100 copies, there's probably not any way you're going to come out ahead.
Well, you're not going to come out ahead financially. A lot of people dream of being rich and famous authors. Actually, today, the best way to conceive of being an author is that it's an expensive hobby. It's like playing golf or world travel or owning a horse or a boat. It's something you spend money on, you don't make money from. The typical book today costs authors more money than those books make. And I'm sorry, that's just the way it is. And if you don't understand that, then you're bound to be disappointed and bitter. If you understand that, then it's like taking a trip around the world. You spend a lot of money, but hey, you have a good time. You come out with an experience you wanted. And if what you want to do is write and publish books, you can do that, but it's probably going to cost you more money than it makes you.
Now, the interesting thing from that I learned from The Untold Story of Books is that, again, harking back to the first book business, most of the early writers didn't actually make all that much money from their books.
Yeah, no one made a living. In early America, no writer made a living from his books. Everybody had other jobs. Louisa May Alcott was a governess. Henry David Thoreau worked in his family's pencil factory. James Fenimore Cooper was an officer with the United States Navy. Oliver Wendell Holmes was a doctor. Ralph Waldo Emerson was a teacher. They all had other jobs that supported them, and writing was their avocation, not their vocation. The idea of authors making a living from their books was very unusual. In the 19th century, only a handful of American writers made livings from their books. And in the 20th century, in the second book business, where we had publishers like we have them today, more people made a living writing books. But it was still a very tiny fraction of authors overall. I mean, the Authors Guild, which is the major organization for authors in the United States, only a very tiny fraction of Authors Guild members make a living. I mean, Stephen King makes a living. The rest of us don't.
But similarly to the first book business, and probably a lot in the second book business too, writing adjacent occupations can provide a living for writers. Teaching, lecturing, editing other people's books.
You're right. And writing other things. I mean, like, I was a magazine writer for most of my career. And I love magazine writing. It's wonderful to mix long-form book writing with short-form magazine writing. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I did make a living as a magazine writer, but I loved the idea of writing books, and so I mixed books into my workflow. But people who are teachers, people who are lawyers, any occupation that supports you well enough to leave enough time for you to pursue your own writing, that's good. I tell people that maybe they should not get the MFA and instead get an MBA so that they can get a job that'll pay enough money to support their writing.
And of course, magazine writing isn't a real viable option these days either, is it?
No. Yes, you're absolutely right. Magazine writing has withered with the rise of the internet, and that's when I got out of magazine writing. I just magazines were folding left and right. I mean, right now in the United States, we have only about half as many magazines as we had in 1990, and a lot of those magazines that folded were the ones I used to write for. And so that no longer became possible. And around the millennium, I saw this happening. I saw the fact that the internet was going to devalue information and basically put a lot of magazines out of business. And that's when I started buying apartment buildings and investing in real estate. And now I'm a landlord.
Well, that's a departure from magazine writing.
It is, but it's... It pays the bills, and it lets me write my books. I wrote The Untold Story of Books while, you know, dealing with my tenants.
Well, congratulations. You definitely, by looking at the business, were able to get ahead.
I think so.
By understanding the business of writing.
Well, it depends how you define get ahead. I mean, getting ahead for a writer always means, you know, making it to the bestseller list, which I have never done. I've written 19 books. Some of them sold really well. None of them have been New York Times bestsellers. But I love to write. I get up every morning eager to write. I write for several hours a day, about 6 days a week, and I love it. And if that's what you love, then the financial challenges, you know, you can put up with them. If what you want to do is write one book, become rich and famous, and retire.
Good luck to you.
Probably not going to happen.
Probably not. Now, where do agents fit into these three book businesses?
Agents began happening with the second book business. In the early 20th century, When publishers as we know them today developed, agents happened then because authors were very confused about these new publishers. Who are these guys? They're paying for manuscripts, but they don't let me title my book. They don't tell me how many they're printing. They don't tell me whether they're going to print. They say they're going to print, and then they didn't. There were all kinds of complaints that early 20th century authors had with the new breed of publishers who paid for manuscripts. So, you know, so agents came in and started advocating for authors. And that's when the Authors Guild developed also. The Authors Guild was founded in 1912. Right around the same time as the second book business was developing, because authors were so frustrated with the new breed of publishers. On the one hand, yes, they would pay you for manuscripts, but you might never see a book. And if you saw a book, it could be filled with all kinds of errors, and they didn't give you discounts when you bought, and there was a litany of complaints. And agents came in, and the combined forces of literary agents, the Authors Guild, and some famous authors who were, you know, alive at the time and writing, famous authors who made a lot of money could actually make demands of publishers, and a lot of the demands that they made trickled down to everyone else. For example, advances. Book advances were unheard of in the 19th century. Book advances were a product of the second book business in the early 20th century, when the new breed of publishers were competing with each other to get the books from the best-selling authors. And those authors and their agents said, yeah, you can have my book, pay me up front. And the publishers said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. And then they said, all right, well, we'll sell to somebody else. And so very quickly, advances became common among the top-selling authors. And over time, from the 1930s into the 1950s, advances basically trickled down to everybody else. And most authors in the 20th century did not make a lot of money in advances, but they made some. That has gone away. Right now, of the 2 million books per year that we're publishing in the United States, approximately 10,000 authors get advances now. That's 0.5%. I got no advance for The Untold Story of Books, zero. And I felt fine about it because I know how competitive the book publishing industry is, and I was just so grateful that somebody was willing to take a chance on The Untold Story of Books. I said, sure, you can have it with no advance. And then I, you know, my agent and I negotiated a contract where at the back end, I get a pretty nice royalty rate. So it, the changes in the business world are always daunting. But if you don't recognize the business world you're actually living in, all you can do is be bitter.
Mm. Yeah. The worst thing, though, of course, for authors, for an author's long-term career in that second book business was to get too large in advance that didn't earn out.
Yes, that was the great peril. If you got an advance and your book did not pay off the advance, the publishing world would rate you as a loser, a bad risk. But, of course, it wasn't until the late 20th century that book scan auditing came in so that publishers actually knew how many copies all the books sold. So before book scan, an author could snag a big advance and then the book didn't earn out and no one knew. The publisher of that book knew that the book had been a flop. But at the time, there were two or three dozen major publishers in New York, and a savvy agent could take the next proposal to one of the other publishing houses and get another big advance. Mm. That's no longer possible. For one thing, there aren't three dozen major publishers anymore. There are only five, the big five. And now with book scan auditing, everyone in the big five and independent presses and everywhere else knows how many copies approximately. A book scan is not perfect, but publishers know approximately how many copies every book is sold. And so that they use that as a bludgeon, a cudgel against authors. And basically they tell agents, your author is only worth as much as their previous book sold. And with sales per title plummeting, books just don't make a lot of money. And unless you're a consistent best-selling author, chances are you're not going to get an advance.
Wow. Wow. Now, in the book, you talk about how book scan doesn't actually, you know, nobody really knows how accurate it is or isn't. But if they don't count books being sold at Walmart, Target, specialty shops, so forth, how in the world can they be accurate?
Book scan says that they track 85% of books that are released, that are in the market. And they don't track at Walmart. They don't track, you know, if you write a knitting book and it's sold at yarn shops, BookScan doesn't track that. BookScan tracks books sold in bookstores and on Amazon. But publishers vehemently deny that that BookScan tracks 85% of sales. I have spoken to publishers who laugh at that number and say they – I talked to one publisher last year who said, you know, we have a book that sold 100,000 copies. If you look on BookScan, they say it only sold 50,000.
Wow.
So I don't know how BookScan does it. I don't know how they calculate sales. But the fact is that when BookScan underestimates book sales, that hurts authors because it looks like the books aren't selling as well as they actually are. And that allows publishers to say, well, you know, you're all, based on BookScan, we're going to offer you this. When in fact the book actually sold a lot better. But I mean, again, that's life here in the 21st century. And again, authors need to understand how this whole thing works or doesn't work, in order to face that blinking cursor in the morning and start writing again.
And I think there's still a lot of writers out there who think, okay, not, you know, getting rich from writing is rare, but somebody does it, and maybe it'll be me.
That's exactly what I told my parents when I was in college. When I was in college, I was an English major, and I wanted to be a writer, and I told my parents that, and they said, a writer, my God, how are you going to make a living? And I said, Mom, Dad, plenty of writers make a living. Why can't it be me? And that's what a lot of writers say and think and feel and believe. And yes, it doesn't happen to everybody, but if you work your butt off like I did, you might just make a living,
and
but not through books.
Although there are some book writers who do seem to be able to make a living, they tend to be in a couple of fields. And you talk about that in The Untold Story of Books.
Yeah, the genres that make the most money, romance fiction. So, for example, Nora Roberts makes a fortune, or Colleen Hoover. I mean, Colleen Hoover last year had three books on the New York Times bestseller list simultaneously. These are all romance fiction, which is the perennial top category of fiction, and women love romance fiction. And women are the readers, and women buy 3/4 of all books and read 2/3 of all books. So the book publishing industry is really aimed at women. You'd never know it.
I was going to say, why are there so many men at the top then?
Yeah, you'd never know it, but that's actually the case. So romance fiction sells very well, and mystery thrillers sell very well. But that doesn't mean that if you write mysteries, you're going to do well. I had a 4-book mystery series that I loved writing and was a lot of fun, and it was set in San Francisco, and it was based on San Francisco history. San Francisco's where I live. I loved writing it, had a great time. And those books, they sold a couple hundred copies. My best-selling mystery, I think, sold about 1,200 copies. It's just, you know, just because romance and mysteries are the biggest selling categories doesn't mean that every romance and mystery thriller is going to sell well.
Right, because there are so many of them.
So many.
Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Michael Castleman, author of The Untold Story of Books. Michael, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
All right. I'm going to, let's see here. All right, I'm going to read, there's a lot of wonderful stuff in the book about writing in the before the year 2000, but people generally ask about what's happening today. And since you're all about writers' voices and writers listen to your podcast, I'm going to read about what's happening now in publishing.
Great.
And so here we go. The digital revolution has transformed every industry, but particularly media enterprises whose product is information. Unlike socks or pineapples, with the necessary gear, information can be dematerialized, transmitted electronically, and reconstituted anywhere on Earth. The implications for book publishing have been profound. Benjamin Franklin once said, "A method should be discovered to print a few copies of a work as cheaply per copy as when many are printed." Digital publishing has granted that wish, and not just because of ebooks. Printing has also become considerably more cost efficient. For up to 500 copies, print on demand can produce a standard trade paperback in record time for less per copy than the cost of a cappuccino. For larger runs, digitized offset printing delivers books at the lowest unit cost ever. Goodbye, gatekeepers. This has been a siren song to legions of authors frustrated by rejections from authors, from agents, and publishers. Digital publishing has freed authors to self-publish cost-effectively, and Amazon is delighted to sell their books. Some self-publishers reinvent the wheel by doing everything themselves, but most contract with publishing services companies who are publishers for hire. If authors are willing to pay, PSCs, publishing services companies, can produce books that appear indistinguishable from those released by the majors. Books no longer go out of print. This is one of the unheralded benefits of the third book business. During the late 20th century, new releases had 6 to 12 months to find an audience. If they did, they went into second printings. If not, publishers pulled them out of print, sending them to the book boneyard. But in the third book business, all books have become digital files that require no warehousing. Digital files can be maintained forever at very low cost. Consequently, these days, very few books ever go out of print. If someone orders one, the file can be printed and shipped. For authors, the downside of digital publishing is a flood of new releases that could swamp Noah's Ark. But the upside is that authors can promote their books now for as long as they have the time, energy, and money. Tons of free books. Since the millennium, books have become so plentiful that forget about selling them, they're increasingly difficult to give away. Consider all the little free libraries. This nonprofit, launched in 2009, boasts 150,000 free public bookcases in neighborhoods from coast to coast. The dozen in my neighborhood are always stuffed full. If you want a specific title, you have to buy it or borrow from a library. But if all you want is something to read, freebies abound. Just go to the little book kiosk in your neighborhood. Median sales per title have plummeted. A tiny fraction of books still sell 100,000 copies. But as new releases have soared, median sales have been sliced thinner than a bookmark. Since 2010, new releases have averaged 2.5 million a year, and books sell around 800 million copies. Divide new titles into the number of books sold, and the average book sells only around 300 copies. But annual sales include both new releases and backlist titles, and in fact, the backlist sells about two-thirds of all books. A backlist title is one that is more than a year old. So when you factor in backlist sales, the average new release sells only about 200 copies. Of course, some titles tell huge numbers, which means that many others sell next to none. The typical self-published book sells fewer than 100 copies. So that's the end of that little bit. But I was also going to read a little bit about e-books.
Perfect, because that's a topic I wanted to get into.
All right, so let's see. E-books began in the late 1990s but did not become phenomenon until Amazon released its Kindle. Which was in 2007. So here we go. In 2007, Amazon launched the Kindle e-reader. The Kindle succeeded for three reasons: trust, convenience, and price. Amazon was already the nation's premier bookseller. Readers trusted the site and were happy to try its e-book reader and its e-books. The Kindle was internet connected. With a few clicks, readers could download up to 200 titles from Amazon's initial catalog of 90,000, which is now about 20 million. And Amazon offered ebooks for just $9.99, half the price of most trade paperbacks. In 2010, Apple introduced its tablet, the iPad, and adapted iPhones to become ebook readers. Reading on the two devices allowed users to turn pages anywhere, anytime. Books can also be read on Android phones. For 8 years, from 2007 to 2014, as e-readers proliferated and ebook sales rocketed upward, many commentators predicted a book business apocalypse. Print publishers and booksellers, they're all dead. There was even a print book on the subject, Print is Dead, and published in 2008. Publishers and booksellers feared that their businesses might collapse. So that was the initial take on ebooks, that ebooks, if you remember that era, everyone was predicting ebooks were going to kill print.
Right.
So now I'm going to fast forward here to a section in the book called The Surprising Decline of Ebooks. From 2007 to 2013, ebook sales undermined print sales and gave many publishers panic attacks. Then, surprisingly, in 2014, ebook sales topped out and began to fall. And then there's a chart that shows that in 2014, 230 million ebooks were sold. And 8 years later, in 2022, only 160 million. It was down 34%. At their peak in 2014, ebooks accounted for 23% of all trade book sales. In 2022, that had fallen to less than 15%. Why did ebooks decline? After all, Amazon has sold more than 30 million Kindles, and all tablets and smartphones are e-readers, and yet sales have fallen for several reasons. One is that ebooks have become genre-specific. Initially, ebooks sold significant numbers across all categories. Today, they account for about half of romance fiction and a third of mystery, thrillers, sci-fi, and fantasy. But for all other genres, a lot less. In fact, for books like histories and biographies, ebooks account for only about 10% of those sales. Print books are much less likely to get stolen. At the beach, I would feel fine leaving a book on my blanket, even a hardback, but I wouldn't leave a Kindle or an e-reader or an iPad there. And the fact is, most people prefer print. Surveys have shown that people like to hold books in their hands. They like the touch of paper. They like to turn pages. And so many of us have jobs where we have to stare at computer screens all day long. When we get home and we want to read books for pleasure, we don't want to look at another screen. We would rather hold a book in our hands. Finally, new media rarely replace old. You know, the idea that ebooks would somehow replace print is this notion that new media replace old media. Actually, that rarely happens. New media change their predecessors. They don't destroy them. For example, in the 1840s, the invention of photography triggered predictions that of the demise of painting. At that time, most visual artists, most painters, made their livings painting portraits. But why hire an artist and sit for hours when a photographer could create an equivalent image faster for much less? But painting didn't die. It just took off in new directions, impressionism, cubism, and all the other art paintings of today. Today, painting thrives. So ebooks have become just another way to read, along with audiobooks, which now gross $1 billion a year. You know, audiobooks make as much money as ebooks do and have gotten a lot less press about it, but audiobooks are as big as ebooks. So ebooks didn't kill print, they changed it. As ebook sales rose, sales of mass market paperbacks tanked. In 2007, pocket paperbacks accounted for 24% of book sales and 15% of book revenue. By 2016, mass market paperbacks had fallen to 10% of sales and 6% of revenue. And so that's how ebooks have changed publishing. They haven't really, they haven't replaced print, and they're not going to.
I mean, in a way, if it's unfortunate because there's more money left over from an ebook because you don't have the cost of printing and distribution.
Right, yes. Initially, when ebooks came out, agents and authors and the Authors Guild went to ebook publishers and said, hey, you know, you don't have to pay for printing, warehousing, shipping, so you're saving money. Authors should make more money. And publishers said, I don't think so. And unless, you know, unless you're Stephen King or a big-time author, you really don't have the leverage to make those demands.
Right.
So
how many self-published books are only published as ebooks? Do you know what percentage?
Yes, most self-published books. Most self-published books are published as ebooks through Amazon's Kindle operation, and the Kindle store sells millions and millions of books. And is fairly welcoming. It's very easy to publish on Kindle Direct. It's just very hard to sell. And there are whole books written about how to position your ebook on Amazon for best sales. There's a whole little cottage industry in trying to suss out how to get the most out of your Amazon page for your books. So yes, there are people who are avid romance and mystery thriller writers who read mostly on Kindles or phones or iPads. But the typical reader, 85% of books are still read in print.
Now, one thing I wanted to talk about a little bit, you know, of course, Amazon is the gorilla in book industry now. In your predictions for the future, you talk about Ingram, the main distributor to bookstores, and Amazon sort of going head to head. But I don't want to neglect to mention bookshop.org. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, bookshop.org is a wonderful, it's a nonprofit bookstore that competes with Amazon. It's a website that competes with Amazon. And, you know, Amazon debuted in 1994, and by the year 2000, Amazon was the nation's biggest bookseller and was starting to dictate terms to publishers, and Amazon put 75% of independent booksellers out of business. Amazon bankrupted the Borders book chain and killed 75% of all booksellers. So you look at those numbers and you would think, well, God, why don't all the booksellers get together and make a website to compete with Amazon? I mean, let's go head to head. Here's this, you know, huge organization putting us out of business. Let's fight them. The American Booksellers Association never did that. Booksellers never did that. They kept saying, oh, we don't have the money, we don't have the expertise, we don't have this, we don't have that. And meanwhile, they were dropping like flies. So about 10 years ago, an entrepreneur who ran a small press in New York, a guy named Andy Hunter, approached the American Booksellers Association and said, hey, you know, let's compete with Amazon head to head. And the ABA told him, well, we're not going to do it, but hey, if you do it, maybe we'll invest, maybe we'll help you out. So this gentleman, Andy Hunter, launched bookshop.org, which is the nonprofit competitor for Amazon. And the American Booksellers Association did get behind it. And most independent booksellers in the United States are now members of it, and they can sell their books online. And the thing about bookshop.org is every time a bookshop sells a book, a certain amount of money is distributed to the member booksellers. And so far, bookshop.org claims to have sent $40 million to the nation's surviving independent booksellers. And so, The one difference between Bookshop and Amazon is that Amazon will virtually guarantee next day delivery of your book, and Bookshop doesn't. Bookshop takes a few days, up to a week, to get you a book. But the thing is, when I buy books, very rarely do I need it the next day. I mean, I've got a stack of unread books on my shelf there next
don't
to my
we all?
I got plenty to read. I don't need books tomorrow. So the big pitch that Amazon makes that, oh, we'll get you the books immediately, I mean, who really needs that? So I try to buy from bookshop.org. I usually get the books within 4 or 5 days, and that's fine. And I would urge people to consider how they want to buy their books. If you want to buy from Amazon, you're free to do that. But if you would like to help nurture and preserve and protect independent bookshops in neighborhoods all around the United States, then please consider bookshop.org.
Absolutely. Do they do ebooks also?
You know, I don't think so. Amazon has that pretty locked up with Kindle.
Yeah. Well, Michael, we're almost out of time, and we haven't even gotten into discussing some of the changes in publishing, like PSCs. So just real brief, the 30-second version, what's a PSC?
A PSC is also known as a hybrid publisher. It is a pay-to-publish outfit. It is a company that is set up to publish books. They know how to do it. They'll get you an ISBN. They can format for print publication, for e-readers, for Kindle, for everything. And you pay to publish. You pay them to publish. And the typical publishing services company charges somewhere between $5,000 and $15,000 to publish a book, depending on the package of services you buy. But it's a lot easier than trying to reinvent the wheel and figure out yourself how to buy an ISBN and format for print and e-readers. So most people today, most authors who pay to publish, do not do everything themselves. They hire a publishing services company.
And that way they can get a book that looks like it came from a publisher and not from their backyard press.
Exactly.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us today. There's a whole lot more into this in this book. So if you have any interest in the history of publishing, I highly recommend The Untold Story of Books by Michael Castleman. And we always close with a quote. And this was from Don Marquis, and it's publishing a volume of verse. It's like dropping a rose petal down the Grand Canyon and waiting for the echo. And I think now that I think that applies to most books now. So.
Oh, I love that. That's a great quote. I wish I had used that. I love that. Thank you for having me on, Monica.
Thank you,
Michael. It's been a wonderful
conversation. Bye-bye, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.